preparatory steps here. Let me get this going. All right, so today we will finish up on Lecture 6 and begin Lecture 7, and undoubtedly not finish Session 7. I think by the end of the semester we'll be done, but I prefer not to worry too much about precise synchronicity between the forecasted syllabus and where we are. It's better just to proceed as we have been. We started some discussion beforehand. There were some questions raised about methodological individualism, which is one of the issues raised in John Elster's commentary. But if anybody, does anyone have other issues, any questions from the readings or from the previous lecture that you'd like to raise? Yeah, Chip.
So I had a question about the Cohen reading. On page 358, he says, if people produce historically not because it belongs to their nature to do so, but for the almost opposite reason that it is a requirement of survival and improvement of their inclement situation, then it follows that the Marxist theory of human nature is, as I contend, an inappropriate basis on which to found historical materialism. But a couple of pages later on 361, it says, people produce because circumstances give them no other choice, but that in producing they exercise their essential powers, yet not because of situational constraint in a satisfactory way. So I understand that philosophical anthropology is saying that people produce because it's in their nature to do so, but the theory of history says people produce because they have to survive. I don't see why, in light of what he says on 361, that basically it's kind of a felicitous coincidence that people have to that people want to produce and they have to produce, and so they're kind of meeting their that need. Why is that then an inappropriate basis? The philosophical anthropology, why is it an inappropriate basis?
Partially, I think it depends on what you're packing into the expression human nature. Right. So Cohen emphasizes human capacities as opposed to some inner spirit to do something. So he's not saying we have a need to be, an inner need, impulse to be creative. We just have the capacity to be creative. We have the capacity, we have intelligence and rationality. So we have the capacity to discover new things and new ways of doing things. That's a capacity. If you want to treat capacities as part of human nature, then fine, it's human nature. Normally, when people say it's human nature, they are referring to motivations. Right? They're referring to something richer than just our capacities. It's our preferences. Now, of course, it's in one sense our human nature and want to survive, but that's more like our animal nature. So I think with respect to motivation, what he's trying to say is there's nothing all that special, distinctively human about our motivations. There's hugely distinctive things about our capacities. I think that's what's in play there. So that the philosophical anthropology, human nature kind of argument, attempts to create a richer portrait of what is our inner nature beyond just what our special capacities are. All of these other more complicated, rich cultural aspects of our nature then are the result of what happens when we deploy our capacities in a particular way and forge communities and language and have to solve problems around the communities to create solidarities and get fishing rituals, so to speak. You know, I mean, but it's all being driven by capacities interacting with a problem we face. We have to transform nature. And then this remarkable byproduct that our capacities change over time, that is, we gain knowledge. Just another point on all of this. Sometimes people feel that economic determinism, and even more so technological determinism, of the sort that Cohen is advocating, implies a marginalization of human agency. That human agency is not at the center of the analysis. And I think that's actually completely wrong. It's not just partially wrong, it's completely wrong. That is, it's hard to imagine a more agent-centered theory than Cohen's, in a certain sense, because it's entirely because people, human beings, have a capacity for intelligent, rational action where they evaluate the world and they try to solve problems, and they have a capacity to actually do so in ways in which they can learn from what they're doing. It's all because of that, and that they're rational. It's all because of that that we can say, yes, the forces of production explain the trajectory of history. It doesn't explain it in spite of human agency. It explains it only by virtue of human agency. There's no other reason by which the forces of production explain anything. Now, one could say, one could still criticize it. One could say it's too thin a notion of agency, that agency isn't just our intelligence and creativity and problem-solving ability. It has all this other stuff, you know, love, spirituality, I mean, all these other aspects of our psyches and our cultural forms. And one could imagine that all of those things really drive human history. One can invoke more a richer human nature. We have a desire to dominate. So that's a good example, right? Cohen doesn't say that people inherently want to dominate each other. There's no inherent property of human beings that makes them want to dominate others, the will to power. That's something which can occur in history, but it's not part of our nature, it's part of our social structure because of particular contradictions and whatever that have emerged. So you could criticize this view of agency by saying it's too thin, that you need some other ingredients in order to get history. But that's a very different kind of criticism. It's not saying, making the incorrect claim that he has relegated human agency to the margins. Is that clear? Because that's a very common criticism of technological determinism and indeed economic determinism, that choice, action, agency doesn't play a role. It's absolutely at the center of Cohen's account. As is struggle. You know, once you get to the later stages of the argument, the transformation of one social structure to another does not happen in spite of the fact that human beings are conscious choosers to make their lives better. It's only by virtue of that, that when the relations of production fetter the forces of production, that people form coalitions to try to transform it. They wouldn't do that. That would not be a response to that circumstance if they weren't intelligent, rational, creative beings trying to solve problems. So that whole line of criticism is just off base. What Cohen is saying is that you can have agency and predictability. You know, if you have a good enough theory of agency, a good enough theory of how people think, how they solve problems, how they confront impasses, if you have a good enough theory of that, you can make some predictions as to what will happen under certain circumstances. But those predictions, again, are not a violation of agency. They're predictions dependent upon agency. The only view of agency that this is really in tension with is a kind of human beings are agents and they act randomly. You know, that makes their behaviors unpredictable. But not that humans are agents with purposes. That doesn't make their behaviors unpredictable. You just have to have a theory of their purposes.
Yeah. And one criticism be that it places agency, human agency, in a secondary place in that, in the sense that people only decide to change the economic system when the technological level tells them to do so.
No, it's that that's the only circumstances in which they can profoundly succeed. Mm-hmm. They try all the time. You know, people are creative and intelligent, but they're not always right in their predictions. So wishful thinking is a very powerful kind of motivation. People attempt to transform social relations even when they can't. So there's lots of struggles to change the world that fail. What historical materialism and Cohen's theory attempts to say is people are constantly trying to get rid of exploitation and oppressions once you're in pre-capitalist class society. So we've made the first transition. We're in the second world of class relations. Right from the start, there was resistance. Slaves never embraced slavery as this great, wonderful thing. Right? They always ran away. They always shuffled their feet as a form of resistance. And periodically, they revolted. But there's only some circumstances in which those struggles succeed. And the claim of historical materialism of the sort Cohen lays out is they succeed really when two kinds of conditions occur. It's really a pretty subtle argument. The existing relations have to be fettering. That is, you have to have a stagnant society, a society that has exhausted its capacity for development. That's one condition. And the second is that an alternative set of relations which would unbottle those forces of production can be reached, are achievable. So you have to have both of those conditions. Then the strong theory of historical materialism is that those two conditions always coincide. That's one of the reasons to be skeptical of it. You know, it's not an implausible argument that when you have a stagnant society and an alternative in the wings, that the preconditions for the alternative have already been set in place, that would redynamize the society. That seems like a pretty favorable condition for struggles to succeed, because the possibility of getting lots of allies in that struggle and getting defections from ruling elites who realize that the current system is degenerate, all of that seems right. Right? In a way, that's the kind of Soviet case of the late 80s, right? The existing system had deteriorated, it was stagnant, it wasn't going anywhere, the West was booming, things were changing. There was a plausible alternative in the wings. Everybody knew there was an alternative. Nobody believed there was no alternative. TINA was not a viable view inside the Soviet Union. The ideology was bankrupt, the legitimacy was bankrupt. The ruling elite saw an escape to an alternative. I mean, that's a ripe situation. Fettering of the forces of production, an alternative that would unfetter it. They coincided. It's less plausible as a grand historical claim that whenever the forces of production are fully fettered by the existing relations, there will be an alternative that's available for transformation. If there were, you know, if that coincidence did occur as a kind of law-like property of social development, then I think the theory of history as laid out would have, this general theory of history would have traction. Does that clarify these? So I think agency runs through this from top to bottom. But it's a particular view of agency: rational, intelligent, problem solving, creative. Those are the attributes of persons. And other attributes of persons, which we might indeed think are important, do not figure in the theory of history. Love, fear of death, aesthetic wonderment. I mean, all these other attributes, which we know are universal attributes. We know of no culture that doesn't have aspects of these. We know that human emotional life is richer than just rational problem-solving intelligence. Cohen isn't denying that those are attributes of persons, just that they don't figure in the explanation for the historical trajectory. You know, they don't give history its dynamism. You don't get hunting and gathering societies eventually becoming capitalist by virtue of motivations rooted in kinship love, in love for one's family. Love and bonding are crucial, perhaps, for social life, but they don't figure in the dynamic that explains change. That's the aspect of agency. It's just these capacities. This is the argument. It's only these capacities which are needed to explain the trajectory. It's not the claim that these capacities and only these capacities are needed to explain everything about social life, just that it's needed to explain the historical trajectory. So it's both a super ambitious claim, but less ambitious, more modest it is sometimes thought. It's not meant to be a theory of everything. It's meant to be a theory of history. Okay, is all that's this set of issues cleared up a bit? Any other questions left over from the reading? All right, well let's return to where we were. We were going through the elements of the technological determinist theory of general theory of history. I want to just remind you what the kind of object of inquiry here is. It is this general theory of history. There is also the special theory of capitalist history. And so there's two kinds of theoretical problems here. Can we construct a theory of all of history governed by a certain kind of general principles that explain each epoch and each transition? You could fail in that and still have a successful theory of capitalist history, of its origins, development, and demise, and transition beyond. So the two are not necessarily dependent upon each other. You could have a successful special theory of capitalist history and an unsuccessful general theory of history. If the two coincide, however, if the special theory of capitalist history is nested in a general theory of history, it adds strength to the theory. It gives kind of more weapons, as it were, to defend its arguments. And I think, ultimately, I think the only thing that really matters in Marxism is the special theory of capitalist history. It doesn't matter whether Marxism is right or wrong about the emergence of classes or about the transition from feudalism to capitalism. It could be completely wrong about the conditions under which capitalism emerges out of feudalism, and yet be absolutely correct about the trajectory of capitalism, its self-destructive dynamics, its laws of motions, and the conditions for its transcendence. And that's really all that matters, you know, in my view. That's the purpose to which it was the theory was developed. It's the reason why it has political relevance in the 20th century and potential relevance beyond. So in a way, we don't need the general theory of history. It still, however, provides so many of the concepts that have become part of the Marxist tradition, as well as being, I think, such an interesting theoretical structure in its own right that it's, I think, worth spending the time we're spending. Okay, so we had gone through the functional explanation for the emergence of classes. I think that's where we were. And we're at the functional explanation for the transformation of classes. Let me just make, actually, there's one comment, I'm not sure if I made it or not, about this starting point of the theory, the tendency of the forces of production to develop. One way of thinking about this is there could be no serious, insistent drive on the part of people to improve the forces of production. That is, it's not that before there was bronze, there was a kind of research and development wing of Stone Age culture where people tinkered with ways of improving the technology. So the theme here is not an incessant drive for improving productivity. That occurs uniquely in capitalism. But what is true is that people are smart and observant. And from time to time, and you can think of this as more or less random, you know, it's more or less a kind of random process. From time to time, essentially, observational geniuses emerge who observe something which they have a kind of leap of understanding, which enables them to see how it could make life better, easier. So presumably, the way in which metallurgy was discovered, a hugely important development in the history of civilization, you know, moving from stone axes to bronze, presumably the way that was discovered was there were shiny metals that were minerals that were observed in rocks. People were curious about them. They would be using those rocks for other things, for fire pits, let's say. And there would be a fire in the fire pit and they would observe it melting. The fire would be hot enough for those very soft metals that they would observe them melting in a fire pit, where the fire pit was there to roast meat, which was captured with stone implements, not with bronze implements. So presumably the discovery of metallurgy was an accident. Was an accident that had probably occurred many, many times before it coincided with an observational genius. You know, somebody who was the Einstein of the Stone Age culture in the sense of being able to put different things together. And then they would experiment. You know, once that was observed, somebody would have had the idea, yes, this could be useful. It melted. They saw it was hard. The residue after the fire went down, they saw that this, and then they thought, yeah, this could be used for something. And they diddled around with it, and then there probably was something equivalent to the R&D department of that community. Probably time and energy was then devoted to somehow figuring out how to push this thing forward. And there was experimentation there. Then the key is, once that's discovered, it is, and it's recognized as making life easier, that you can cut down things better with a bronze edge than you could with a stone axe, that it was useful for all sorts of things that made life less precarious and reduced the risk aspect, or easier, you know, the different ways in which welfare is improved. Once that knowledge was acquired, then it was taught. And social energy was placed into reproducing the knowledge over time to ensure that the young people would observe and would watch and would learn how to do it. And then in contact with other communities, it would quickly spread. The diffusion would be reasonably rapid once these discoveries were initially made. So the key idea of the development of the forces of production as a general trans-historical tendency is, once we learn something, even if it's by accident, we don't forget it. We pass it on. And so that the acquisition of knowledge about transforming the world has this cumulative character. It's because it has a cumulative character that we can say the forces of production develop in history. And it's also because it has a cumulative character that it's plausible that this is what imparts some kind of weak directionality to overall historical development. You know, so if there's going to be a directionality to history, there has to be some kind of cumulative dimension that's not as easily reversed. It's what I'll refer to later, or use another context, you'd say that the development of the forces of production are sticky downward. It's not that it can't regress, but the probability of the forces of production either staying at the level they're at or advancing is always greater. Those two probabilities together are greater than the probability of a regressing. As long as that's true, which seems to me almost certainly true, as long as those things are true, then you'll have a cumulative character to the development of the forces of production. And then if the development of the forces of the production has any kind of really systematic ramification for other aspects of social structure, the development of the forces of production will impart a directionality to other aspects of the social structure. And then what Cohen tries to do is to show why we can actually theorize the nature of the relations that it imparts. The first transition, then, is that there is this accidental discovery of ways of storing grain and planting seeds and so on. That's some kind of combination of observational genius and accident. It develops especially in alluvial areas because that's where this technology can take off most easily. It's undoubtedly tried in many other places. It's not that the observations only require fluvial plains, but it's when the observation gets applied in the fluvial plains that suddenly there's a huge surplus. A huge surplus opens the door for a division of labor between those who produce the surplus and those who don't. And then through a trial and error process of combinations of raiding other communities and subordinating subpopulations within one's community, this potential division of labor is actualized in the form of those who live off the surplus but don't produce it and those who produce the surplus. And the way of maintaining that relationship turns out to be highly coercive. Slavery is the primary form of these initial pre-class, pre-capitalist class societies. Once you get that division of labor, what happens is the forces of production develop more rapidly than they did before. So there gets to be an advantage to societies that have made this transition. This doesn't mean an advantage for the quality of life of people, however. The quality of life of the direct producers, the people actually producing the surplus, could become much worse than under the previous situation. The lives of hunters and gatherers with modest animal husbandry and modest agricultural stores, you know, for risk reduction, the quality of life for those kinds of communities for the average person could be much greater than under the slave forms of subordination in early agrarian civilizations. So this is not a question that human well-being is improved. It's just that once this transition gets made for these historically contingent reasons of one community figuring out how to successfully subordinate another and reproduce their subordination, then those kinds of social structures stabilize and have a comparative advantage relative to others. So they're able to conquer their own hinterlands, they're able to create agrarian civilizations and agrarian empires, and for thousands of years those become the dominant form of class relations, within which then the forces of production develop way beyond what they were able to develop under the prior class regime. The fact that that becomes stabilized as a social structure is explained, in Cohen's view, by the fact that it did indeed foster the subsequent development of the forces of production. Because that generates greater surplus-producing capacity. That surplus can then be used to reproduce those class relations, to create a superstructure, to stabilize those relations and make them less vulnerable to assault. So, is the argument is clear enough? All right, now, we've got three capitalist class relations. Cohen argues that we cannot really sensibly differentiate all these in any kind of historical sequence. There's a whole variety of forms of pre-capitalist class relations. We can have a typology of them. We can say that one form or another occurs where it occurs because under those conditions, under the conditions in which it exists, it's functional for the development of the forces of production. So you get tributary forms of class relations under conditions where you have large irrigation systems needed to develop the forces of production to maximize productivity under those conditions, where large irrigation systems ecologically are possible. But you don't get tributary empires or what sometimes were called hydraulic civilizations, where large irrigation systems are not the way in which agricultural productivity is organized. That's why Marx referred to those as the Asiatic mode of production, with Vogel, I think, called them hydraulic civilizations. More recent writers have used the term tributary modes of production as a way of describing the social relations. That, I think, is the better term. Whether or not it has flaws, I haven't engaged these debates to know what the debates over that idea. But that seems to capture the way the surplus is produced and extracted and then distributed to the state and to the ruling elite in civilizations that have had these very large public works around irrigation as a necessary condition for the production of a surplus. Now, the question then is, now we're in this pre-capitalist class relation. How do we explain transitions out of that class structure? Why doesn't that just simply remain, once established, a forever social structure? After all, the class structures that are established under these initial, the initial transition from pre-class to pre-capitalist class society, these class structures are stabilized by elaborate forms of religion and ideology and culture and the state. Yeah.
It's going to throw it out there that perhaps if the population continues to grow and the society grows in raw complicatedness, it becomes necessary at some point to sustain the complexity of the society, to add more energy, and be it in the forms of raiding other empires and taking their stuff, or whatever. They just need new sources of food and energy for the society if the population continues to grow.
Right, but why would this class structure ever be transformed? What's the reason? How do we explain the transformation of the pre-capitalist class relations into the capitalist class relations? Yeah.
I just want to bring up the point that like the transition from pre-class to pre-capitalist was supposedly very like decentralized, right? You know, tributary in one part of the world and feudal in another part of the world. And I wonder, and I just want to bring up the point of what that mechanism is, that they all, you know, this happened in a decentralized way. The fact that the transition from pre-capitalist to capitalist society happened, you know, in Europe, and then because of perhaps, you know, dominant forms of transport and communication, it radiated out from a center. You know what I mean? So I guess just the question of what would have happened, could there have been other types of transition from pre-capitalist to capitalist societies in a decentralized way?
So the theoretical argument is that eventually the transition from pre-capitalism to capitalism would have happened somewhere. It didn't have to be the case that the first place was Europe. That's contingent. Europe happens to have a particular character because of its climate, because of the way water ways work in Europe, because of the presence of islands that have, you know, natural defenses. There's all sorts of reasons why, because Europe was the residue of the Roman Empire and broke up in a particular way. There's all sorts of features of Europe that might have made it the likely first place. But there were moments in the history of China where it looked like it might have had a capitalist breakthrough. You know, there was a thriving merchant culture at some points that then got curtailed. There was certainly a advanced technology. It didn't quite break through to industrial production, but, you know, give China another 10,000 years or 2,000 years or 400 years, who knows? If there hadn't been a Europe, maybe the breakthrough would have happened in China or Japan. There was certainly internal dynamics and contradictions in Japan that were very powerful and moving in capitalist ways, which then got super accelerated with contact with Europe. But Japan, unlike much of the rest of the world, endogenously transformed into capitalist rather than through conquest and penetration. That is, Japan is quite distinctive in this respect, and it's an important example of not having capitalism, once it developed in Europe, simply spread and take over a place that was pre-capitalist. It rather triggered an endogenous development of capitalism.
So is there some sort of mechanism, some sort of reason why it develops into this uniform type of capitalism, whereas the pre-capitalist stage had this wide variety of economic systems?
I mean,
is it the only way to develop the course?
So capitalism isn't all that uniform. There's huge varieties of capitalism. So it's only at a very high level of abstraction that we can say both contemporary China, Sweden, and the United States are all capitalists. These are very different kinds of places. The quality of life of persons are different. You know you're in a different place when you lose a job in one part of the capitalist world compared to another part of the capitalist world. So it's not really true that there aren't huge varieties of capitalism. We lump them all together because we have a good theoretical understanding. The pre-capitalist class relations can also all be lumped together because they all rely on extra economic coercion to extract the surplus. So you, if you want a, one way of building the typology that would avoid the term pre-capitalist class society, that would just define it negatively with respect to capitalism, you could call them coercively extractive class societies. They all involve the use of direct coercion on direct producers to extract surplus. Tributary forms do that, slave forms do that, feudal forms do that. They all revolve around the use of direct coercion, whereas capitalist surplus extraction doesn't involve direct coercion. It's not, it works through economic mechanisms, yeah.
The difference there, though, isn't the difference there between those pre-capitalist class societies is the relationship of labor to the means of production. And in capitalism, even if you take the wide variety of existing capitalisms, that basic relation doesn't change much, does it?
Well, the, I mean, even there, there's variations across countries in the extent to which, for example, workers have pensions that have stock ownership as part of their pensions. So the extent of diffusion of certain kinds of capitalist property rights into the laboring population varies a lot across capitalist countries. And that would be an example, you know, that would be an example of there being variability. The degree to which workers have rights to their jobs, have actual quasi-property rights in their jobs, that is, it's very hard to fire them. There was a time in Japan when for a significant part of the labor force, it was virtually impossible to fire people. They had lifetime contracts. Well, is it really the case that the relationship to the means of production of somebody with a lifetime contract and somebody who can be fired at will is the same? Well, probably not. No, those really are quite different kinds of social relations. So job rights constitute a type of, at least, quasi-property right in employment, which makes the labor market free in a different sense. Everyone is free to quit. That makes it not slavery. But you're not free to fire. That's really, I think, pretty deep variant in any case. And there's other, you know, other issues along these lines that we could explore as well. We'll discuss some of this when we get to the section of the course on class structure. One of the themes is to have a sufficiently subtle and flexible concept of the social relations of production that you can actually capture this kind of variation theoretically rather than just descriptively. That is, we can give theoretical precision to the ways in which class structures vary. And this would be just an example, the kinds of rights people have in jobs. I would regard as a variant a way that class structures vary, not just the way work varies. So what Cohen wants to argue is that the same functionalist reasoning can apply to the transition between pre-capitalism and capitalism as to the initial transition. And furthermore, with a little bit of tweaking to the transition beyond capitalism. So he wants to apply this initial logic to the other two arguments, same sort of functionalist explanations. And it's complicated because we've got the functionalist explanations in historical materialism is this double interconnected functionalism, right? There's a functional explanation of that connects the forces and relations of production, and there's a functional explanation that connects the superstructures to the relations of production. We've got these two interlocked functional explanations. The superstructures are functionally explained by the need to stabilize the base. So they hold that economic structure in place, prevent it from changing. The economic structure is functionally explained by the need to rationally develop the forces of production. And then what happens when the base ceases to allow for the development of the forces of production? That is, the society stagnates. You have a stagnant set of forces of production. The economic structure ceases to be a source of development but becomes a fetter. But you still have the superstructure that holds it in place. So that's the context in which transformation occurs. Here is how Cohen describes this. Once exploiting classes are established, if their rule is to be stabilized, then political and ideological superstructures must emerge, either by design, trial and error, or luck, which have the effect of reproducing the power of such exploiting classes. The forces of production, however, continue to develop under the double impulse of human beings contending with nature and ruling classes appropriating the surplus. This, I'm not sure if this is Cohen's words in my notes or my gloss on it. Sounds more like my words than Cohen's. It is, however, a dead accurate rendition of what Cohen means. This development may be exceptionally slow and erratic, but technical change will continue within the institutional constraints of a given class structure. This continued expansion of the productive forces sets the stage for the central contradiction announced by Marx in the preface to A Contradiction to a Critique of Political Economy. The social relations of production become institutionally frozen through the creation of political and ideological superstructures, which maintain the particular ruling class in power while the forces of production continue to develop. Eventually, it is argued, the forces of production reach the limits of possible expansion under the existing relations of production. So eventually, those forces of production develop as far as they possibly can, given the existing relations of production. The relations then cease to stimulate the development of the forces of production, but instead become fetters on such development, obstacles to the future enhancement of productivity. They change from sources of development to fetters on development. This constitutes what is called the contradiction between the forces and relations of production. That situation. Now, how is this contradiction resolved? There are basically three possibilities. Okay, so here are, I think this is exhaustive. The forces of production could regress. So you could have a situation where forces develop, they hit a barrier, and then they decline to the point where they can develop again, they hit the barrier, they decline. So you could have a kind of ebb and flow of the development of the force of production encountering the barrier. You could have a condition of permanent stagnation, not just long, but permanent. Or the relations of production could be transformed in such a way to allow for the future development of forces of production. So one possibility, hits the barrier, regress. Hits the barrier, regress. Another possibility, hits the barrier, stays at that level. Third possibility, hits the barrier breaks, and the forces of production can develop further. The functional arguments of Cohen suggest that the third of these would have a tendency to be the long-term outcome. It's not that there's no time frame specified. So Marx, in the Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy in the preface, uses a kind of rhetorical device that makes it seem like as soon as this contradiction occurs, you then enter the era of revolution and instability. So he seems to suggest a very rapid disintegration of the capacity to reproduce the relations of production once this barrier is hit. There's really no justification for that claim. That's just part of the, you know, the discursive poetry of revolutionary thinking rather than an analytical argument. There's no reason to imagine that instability is provoked instantaneously by the fettering of the force of production. But the argument is that under a long enough period of time, that fettering will be corrosive of those relations of production, and social forces will emerge to challenge those constraints, to take advantage of new possibilities, and then eventually this will have the effect of transforming the relations. In the case of the transformation of feudalism, the reason why the feudal form was so more amenable than the tributary form, these highly centralized states of the large irrigation societies, why the feudal form was more amenable to a shattering of the relations of production, was precisely because it was a much more fragmentary society with many more niches and, you know, pockets of places where alternative relations of production could be created. And basically it had to do with the relationship between the feudal state and cities. That cities became enclaves within which proto-capitalist activities could take place from quite early on, and then become kind of demonstration projects for alternatives. So what happens in late feudalism, and feudalism as it begins to stagnate, is that feudal landlords see advantages of investing part of their surplus in proto-capitalist activity, merchant activity especially, merchant capitalism especially. You get, you get stories like The Merchant of Venice, which reflects the way feudal lords are investing in merchant enterprises to get a capitalist return through trade, not through capitalist production. But this all kind of corrupts the integrity of the feudal relations themselves. Feudal lords become investors. The management of investment houses, initially as merchants, then begin to invest in the production of the things which they are trading. So you get proto-industry and so on developing in the spaces that are possible within the feudal order. So by the time feudalism really becomes moribund, there's already many of the elements of an alternative already in place. So it's not really the case that you have an intact feudal society which becomes stagnant, which then gets destroyed to make capitalism possible. What you have is an intact feudal society which becomes stagnant simultaneously with the emergence inside of feudalism itself of alternatives as people try to get around the stagnation by finding alternative ways of doing things. And feudalism is sufficiently flexible and disorganized and has these cracks and segmentations to make possible that those alternatives. It's what I would describe as interstitial transformations taking place inside of feudalism. Those interstitial transformations do hit barriers, though. That is, it's not that the existence of the feudal state and feudal ideologies and all of these things, it's not that all of these don't impede the flowering of these new proto-capitalist forms and their development. They do hit barriers, and they do generate lots of conflict. And it's very uneven. And the big revolutionary breakthroughs occur basically not just because the forces of production have been fettered by feudalism, but the emergent forms of capitalism are fettered by the continued existence of feudalism. That's why those revolutions are called, for better or worse, bourgeois revolutions. You know, there's lots of debates as to whether that's an appropriate term, because capitalists didn't actually figure very prominently in most of the big revolutionary movements, but we can leave those issues aside. The Cohen argument then is that once that breakthrough occurs, and the story I told you is one possible way of understanding that breakthrough, then capitalism takes off and the forces of production develop hugely fast, because capitalism, in contrast to earlier forms of class relations, doesn't simply allow for the development of the forces of production, it massively fuels the development of the forces of production. This gives capitalist states and societies a huge advantage over their pre-capitalist cousins that are still around in the world, both in military terms. A lot of what early capitalism does is conquer. It uses military force to subordinate pre-capitalist societies, but also economically. They are able to produce things that the ruling elites of non-capitalist parts of the world want. They value the consumption goods and the capacities that are being generated in capitalism. In some places, like Japan, that's recognized very early on. You know, that's the whole story that's often told of the revolution from above and the Meiji Restoration is the, you know, that early, late 19th, I don't remember the dates, or late 19th, early 20th century, when a capitalist industrial project is launched from above. But Japan, of all the East Asian regions, had a class structure and social structure prior to capitalism that looked the most feudal. You know, it looked very much like Europe in a lot of ways. That then brings us into capitalism. I will leave the story of the demise of capitalism, the next transition, for the lecture on the special theory of capitalist history, because it has its own distinctive properties. But if the account so far had, if it had the character of a set of law-like mechanisms and arguments, then it would enable us, even before we discover the specific mechanisms of capitalist history, to make the prediction that capitalism, like all other sets of class relations, will eventually fetter its real forces of production. And when that happens, eventually, those relations of production will disintegrate under the pressure to unbottle the forces of production, which would lead to a transformation of capitalism. If the general theory had comprehensive explanatory power.
Just thinking about the notion that, like, at our advanced stage of capitalism right now, we already have, the forces of production have developed to the point where there's enough out there for everyone in the world to live and, you know, and to have enough resources to survive. But just that the problem is distribution, right? You know, if all the resources are stuck at the top. So I guess the transition from capitalism to socialism, or whatever you want to call it, would it be necessarily because the forces of production need to develop more? Right? Is the issue not kind of distribution at this point?
So Cohen has a Cohen recognizes this as an issue, and he argues that actually the most plausible way of understanding fettering in capitalism is what he calls use fettering rather than development fettering. So use fettering means that the relations of production block the rational use of our forces of production. That is, our knowledge of how to produce and transform nature is being irrationally used because it's deployed under capitalist conditions. The clearest example is environmental destruction. So, if global warming is a byproduct of capitalist production, that clearly indicates that we are not rationally using our existing knowledge of production. We're not using our capacity to transform nature in a rational way. That is, it's not being used in a way to improve the quality of life of the people who use those means of production. It's being used for other purposes. So if it's, rather than the big problem we face is that capitalism is blocking new technological innovation and new knowledge. So what Cohen argues is that the distinctive contradiction of capitalism is between the rational use of the means of production and the relations of production, which is still a contradiction between forces and relations of production, but not a contradiction that between relations of production and the development of those forces of production. One might also, though, argue that there still is a development fettering going on. It's not simply the rational use of what we already know. That is, the direction of technological development under capitalism, because it's subordinated to profit maximizing, and because it has a very short time horizon by virtue of its subordination to profit not maximizing, is qualitatively directed in a particular way. So the development of new forms of productivity, so it's still a question of development, not just use, of new forms of productivity that would be compatible with sustainability and quality of life, that is being blocked. So certain kinds of development are being blocked, as well as existing productivity being misused under capitalist relations. That's as we'll see when we discuss the special theory of capitalist history, I think that's a very compelling argument, but it doesn't have quite the force that the simpler argument has, because it doesn't predict as cleanly the stagnation of the society. And stagnation provides a kind of stronger argument for why the system won't reproduce itself over time. A system that's irrational but still dynamic has a lot of capacity for reproduction, whereas a system that's not dynamic, that is stagnant, that's reached a complete impasse in its ability to develop its productivity, is a more vulnerable one. Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, exactly that point, that the irrational use of the mode of production, and it can be more like dealt with by, you know, just the fact that it's still very profitable to use it irrationally. But perhaps the point of the greatest stagnation that it'll achieve is when that, due to just the always expansionary and hungry nature of capitalism, that once it runs out of places to invest, once it runs out of things to privatize, new areas of investment in the third world, places to exploit, once it runs out of those, that's when it's going to reach the greatest point of stagnation, that it starts imploding because there's nowhere to put surplus capital to be destroyed into new investments. You know, once it's privatized, every bit of education, of water, of everything, that's when it will...
Right, so there is an argument, there is an argument in the special theory of capitalist history that it will also have a complete stagnation.
Well, yes.
Right. That stagnation will also be the destiny of capitalism. I think there's reasons to be skeptical of that. But that's bad. The idea that eventually the world becomes so saturated with capitalism, there's no place for capitalism to expand. It's possible, but I don't. We'll engage that argument when we deal with the special theory of capitalist history. It's a hard argument to actually show the mechanisms by which that would be true. Why, Mark? Why capitalism can't simply be deepening its markets rather than expanding to new markets, new places? That is, because it produces new products all the time. So, unless you reach the point where capitalism has exhausted its capacity to produce anything new, any new products, then there's no reason to believe that markets become perpetually saturated. And therefore, accumulation can continue, even if it's irrational. It still would be vulnerable to the use-fettering argument that all of these new things that are being produced are destroying the planet and not making human welfare any better. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, they allow for continued accumulation.
But just to say, in terms of consumption, though, I mean, like, at a certain point, aren't you going to run out of increasing consumption? Because, I mean, wages can only do so much, and eventually, you know, I guess perhaps it will outstrip, or the need to expand will outstrip the amount of input that can come from consumption in general.
There's no inherent reason for that to be the case, because a lot of consumption, first of all, consumption can be non-material. We consume entertainment goods all the time that don't involve any inputs to speak of, and people have new needs. They throw away, Americans throw away an astounding amount of clothing. You know, in weight, I mean, my figures may be a little off, I can bring them, I have them at home. 50 years ago, the average American consumed 10 pounds of clothing a year, and now it's 40 pounds of clothing a year just by weight. It's quite absurd, and it's not because the fabrics wear out more today than they did 40 years ago. It's just because of the cost structure of clothing and the way advertising works on fashion, and all sorts of mechanisms are involved in the excessive use of clothing. So I don't think the capacity for consumption is inherently limited. It may be ecologically limited, that's a separate matter. The destruction of the planet in the service of capitalist consumption is a different issue, and it's certainly a source, but that's use fettering, that's not development fettering. Well, that brings us to the end of the exposition. Yeah.
I just had a follow-up for that it seems to me that consumption is in fact limited, because if you don't have wages that can support people buying 40 pounds of clothes a year, they have to go into credit. And then you get into the credit markets, and you know, if you look at what happened in 2008, I'm not saying that was exactly
right,
but you could have some sort of credit crisis, and then that would be, if that is perpetuated, that would be the limit to consumption, would it not?
Well, you can have crises, people can be miserable, you have an economic decline, and then you start again. I mean, you know, the cyclical crises have been a chronic feature of capitalism. They cause a lot of havoc in people's lives, but they have the effect of destroying productivity and capacity to produce and creating space for new production to take place. So it's not clear that any of these things are inherent limits. They may become, in practice, limits. That is, it could be that, and some people argue, that the scalar dislocation between the capacity to have states that regulate the economy in a non-destructive way, so that capitalist economies would destroy themselves instantly without forms of state regulation, that because the capitalist economy is organized globally, but states remain national, and the possibility of states becoming global is virtually nil because of the complexity of forming systems of coordination across such unevenly developed territories. And the capacity for one state to become sufficiently hegemonic to impose regulation globally is also weak because we're in a multipolar, multi-development world. So one argument is that the capacity to have crisis-containing countermechanisms of the sort which have worked pretty well, all things considered, in the past, that capacity is being seriously eroded. So that the kind of crisis which we are still in the midst of is not one that's going to have the historic pattern of a period of distress followed by new periods of growth. That what's going to happen is continually aborted periods of growth and continual chaos and an unraveling, basically, of the capacity of the superstructure to reproduce the base. That would then mean that the relations of production become vulnerable to challenge because the superstructure is incapable of reproducing them. That's one kind of argument. I think that it's probably not likely that as a scenario, but we can, you know, we'll have plenty of time to discuss those sorts of alternatives. That's the kind of reasoning, though, that you know, if you were an historical materialist that wanted to see the same kind of mechanisms that operated historically to also explain the transformations beyond capitalism, that's the sort of thing you would be looking for. You'd be saying the conditions under which capitalism becomes transformable are ones when its superstructures are no longer capable of reproducing its relations of production. And it's possible that the scalar mismatch between states and the economy could be a circumstance in which the superstructures are no longer capable of reproducing the conditions of production. At that point, then, the question is there an alternative available for such transformation in the way there was in late feudalism? The alternative is already built and there and ready to go, so to speak, once the fiscal crisis of the feudal state occurred in France, let's say, and it became vulnerable to challenge. I think we should take our break, reconvene at a quarter after, and we will turn to the topic of today's lecture, which is the critique of this